How did American women get the vote? How did American women get into higher education? How did American women get into the professions? Lesbian couples were in the forefront of all of those battles.
Hey, Zachary, what's my name? Is my name Daddy?
No.
No?
What's his name?
What's my name?
That's Daddy.
Well, that's Daddy. What's my name?
Daddy, Papa.
And since they're teaching, we're all teaching the rest of the world to accept our family as legitimate as any other.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Global Days of Action protest Egyptian persecution. A renowned historian reveals feminism's lesbian roots, and Daddy and Papa raise kids and consciousness. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Ralph Radabaugh.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending May 17th, 2003. Gays and lesbians and their allies in more than a dozen nations around the world took part this week in a global day of action protesting persecution of gay men in Egypt. While demonstrations continued throughout the week, UK-based human rights watchdog Amnesty International organized the protest on the second anniversary of the notorious police raid at Cairo's Queen Boat, a gay-friendly Nile riverboat nightclub. More than 60 men were arrested, 53 tried for debauchery, and after a retrial for 50 of them, 23 are serving prison terms of up to 5 years. Scores of other gay men have been arrested over the last 2 years, some by internet stings, and last month another 14 were sentenced based on police tapping one man's phone. Suspects have reportedly experienced abuse and even torture at the hands of police.
Amnesty declared in a press release it beggars belief to hear the Egyptian government maintain that homosexuality is not a criminal offense in Egypt, when there is clear evidence that charges of debauchery and prostitution are being used to criminalize consensual homosexual relations. The systematic persecution of those perceived to be gay is a blatant and unacceptable breach of Egypt's human rights obligations. The Egyptian government must release immediately and unconditionally all those imprisoned solely on the grounds of their sexuality. The international community must make it clear to Egypt that there will be consequences if it continues to treat people this way.
Protest actions were planned for Berlin, Geneva, Hong Kong, London, Manila, Montreal, Oslo, Paris, Toronto, the Norwegian city of Bergen, and several Irish cities.
In Madrid, a march down the famous street La Rambla featured a sign reading, "One person is murdered by homophobia in the world every other day."
Frankfurt's action featured a bit of street theater in which Amnesty members wearing police uniforms raided 5 bars, pretending to arrest men for debauchery and indecency.
Groups in Malta and the Philippines sent letters of protest to the Egyptian government.
In New York City, protesters rallied in front of the Egyptian consulate.
3 U.S. congressional Democrats, open gay Barney Frank of Massachusetts, open lesbian Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, and non-gay Tom Lantos of California, this month wrote a letter to every member of the House of Representatives urging them to withhold support for a U.S. free trade agreement with Egypt until the persecution ends. Egypt receives $2 billion annually in U.S. foreign aid, more than all but one other nation.
At the other end of the African continent, 4 national governments' pervasive harassment and violence against lesbian gays and transgenders are documented in a new report released jointly this week by Human Rights Watch and IGLHRC, the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission. Botswana, Namibia, Zambia, and Zimbabwe are the focus of the nearly 300-page report entitled "More Than a Name: State-Sponsored Homophobia and Its Consequences in Southern Africa," which was developed from 3 years of research and interviews. It also reviews the status of sexual minorities in South Africa, finding that despite the pioneering equality guarantee in its constitution and recent legal victories for gays and lesbians there, political leaders' silence and foot-dragging have left those gains fragile. A member of the South African Commission on Gender Equality confirmed that perception, noting discrimination by institutions ranging from police to schools.
Igelhurk Executive Director Paula Edelbrick said that in Southern Africa, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people have been vilified by presidents and political leaders, which has led to a culture of intolerance. These attacks are just the first step in creating a climate in which all rights are at risk. Report co-author Scott Long of Human Rights Watch added, when Southern African political leaders like President Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe make speeches saying that gays and lesbians are worse than dogs and pigs, it should be no surprise that violent attacks follow. The report urges all five nations to repeal anti-gay laws, enact laws against discrimination, create means to respond to discrimination and abuse, and promote awareness of those protections.
At least three men charged for homosexual acts were executed this week in the Iranian city of Mashhad, a Shiite holy place, according to Tehran's Sedeh-e-Edelat newspaper. Other charges against them included sex crimes against women. They were reportedly part of a gang. Five other members were executed and 135 more sentenced to prison terms plus floggings, but the report did not specify the charges leading to those punishments.
A bill to overhaul Puerto Rico's penal code was introduced this week, but it still includes the existing statute that makes homosexual acts between consenting adults a felony punishable by 10 years imprisonment. The bill's authors explain they are awaiting the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in a challenge to Texas's sodomy law before they attempt to redefine it. Puerto Rico is a commonwealth of the U.S. The lawmakers also emphasize that their submission is only the beginning of a process of public hearings and legislative analysis. Igelhurk, the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, has already called for an international letter-writing campaign for elimination of the sodomy law, which was based on California law as it read in 1902.
Puerto Rican activists have long lobbied for sodomy repeal. The law is not known to have been enforced in recent years, even when some activists confessed to police. But its continuing power was demonstrated recently when Puerto Rico's Supreme Court declared that a law against domestic violence could not be applied to same-gender couples. Puerto Rico's government has asked the court to reconsider that split decision. In fact, a week ago, Puerto Rico's family secretary announced her unqualified support for extending to same-gender couples those public services and benefits now reserved for married couples.
There would be legal recognition of gay and lesbian couples in Scotland next year. Under a bill that will be introduced by newly elected openly gay member of the Scottish Parliament, Patrick Harvey. The Glasgow Greens private member's bill entitled Civil Partnerships is expected to attract support from within several parties. But its progress may be delayed by the Scottish Executive as it awaits the UK government's report on public consultation regarding possible registered partnerships. Harvey's bill would allow couples, regardless of gender, to register partnerships with status equal to married couples in areas including insurance, property, and inheritance. Some matters, such as taxation and welfare benefits, remain under the control of the UK rather than Scotland's jurisdiction.
The British Parliament's first openly gay member, Labour's Chris Smith, confirmed this week that he will not seek re-election. When his current term ends, he'll have been in the Commons for 22 years, and he said he's ready for a new challenge. Smith, who served in Tony Blair's cabinet as Secretary for Culture until 2001, is moving into the directorship of the CLOR Cultural Leadership Program, where he'll be training arts managers.
A second transgender mayor in India has been stripped of her office by a court. This week, a judge set aside Asha Devi's landslide 2000 election in the Uttar Pradesh town of Gorakhpur, ruling that she is male and therefore disqualified from a post reserved for a female. One of her badly defeated opponents had filed the legal challenge, and Devi refused to comply with the court's request that she undergo sex testing. The judge suspended his order for a month to allow Devi to appeal to the state high court, which she has vowed to do despite being unable to personally afford it.
India's Supreme Court has agreed to take up the appeal of transgender Kamla Jan, who was similarly removed from the mayoralty of the town of Katni and lost her appeal to the Madhya Pradesh State High Court. Although the Indian term hijra is often translated as eunuch, most of them are transgenders and gay men with intact genitalia.
The highest administrative court in Greece has ordered the closure of what's reportedly the nation's most popular gay bar, the Pieros Bar on Mykonos. The Council of State upheld five local residents' claim that the Pieros is violating zoning laws by operating a business in an area restricted to residential use. The plaintiffs had long been unable to convince local officials to enforce those laws against the Pieros.
And finally, you might not have expected it from a daughter of the late tyrant Ferdinand Marcos, but Congressmember Imei Marcos this week proposed that the Philippines government designate a day to honor gays and lesbians. She cited the outstanding work of gays and lesbians in the arts, fashion, and academics, and said, "The sad part is they've not gotten any support from the government. Some members of society still look down on them. It is now time to give them their much-deserved recognition." Marcos suggested calling the occasion X-Men's Day, since X-Men has become the latest Filipino slang for gay in the wake of the two recent popular films about those superhero mutants. Marcos declared, "Our X-Men are just like Wolverine. They are our heroes. There is hope and fun when you are with them."
That's News Wrap for the week ending May 17th, 2003. Written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Ralph Radabaugh.
With hundreds of thousands of children looking for permanent homes in the U.S., only a few are lucky enough to get both a daddy and a papa. Four of those families are featured in a hit documentary, and our Steve Pride has a preview later in the program. To hear many accounts of the feminist movement's progress since the mid-19th century, you'd think that the presence of lesbian activists was a relatively recent development. That's a major misconception, according to renowned lesbian historian Lillian Fatterman, author of such books as Surpassing the Love of Men, Romantic Friendships and Love Between Women from the Renaissance to the Present, and To Believe in Women, What Lesbians Have Done for America, A History. This Way Out's Josie Catoggio chats with Fatterman about the contributions of woman-loving women during the first wave of feminism.
For the people that haven't read Surpassing the Love of Men, it's very important to establish the concept of passionate friendships and what that meant before the concept of lesbian even existed. So could you do that briefly, please?
Yeah, in Surpassing the Love of Men, I talk about romantic friendship and love between women in other centuries. I actually begin with the Renaissance, and I talk about how the relationships looked from the outside. I not only focus on the Renaissance, but the 17th century, the 18th century, the 19th century. And the point that I make is that these intense, passionate love relationships between women were generally accepted because people from the outside didn't even entertain the erotic possibilities of the relationship. And as Henry Wadsworth Longfellow said in the middle of the 19th century, such relationships were a rehearsal in girlhood for the great drama of woman's life, by which he meant, of course, marriage. But the point was that if a young woman had an intense, passionate, romantic relationship with a man, that would have had some kind of danger to her virginity. If she practiced romance with another young woman, that would not have endangered her virginity. And so I think that's the reason why, from the outside at least, these passionate, devoted, very often committed romantic friendships were socially approved. That changed, I think, with the proliferation of sexological sophistication in the United States and Western Europe.
Well, talk briefly about the concept of the invert, which was kind of the next thing that came along that defined relationships between women that were committed and passionate.
Yeah, the sexologist came along in the latter half of the 19th century in Western Europe and then in America, and defined a whole category of women who loved other women. And they pathologized that category. Very often, in fact, in the beginning, they said that women who loved other women were really men trapped in women's bodies. Later on, they modified that notion, and so they were concerned not just with what they considered gender inappropriate behavior, but then they began to be concerned with the potential of female-female sexuality. And it seems to me that it was only then, particularly for middle and upper class women, that the whole notion of these intense, passionate relationships came to be called into question.
Well, actually, your first book was about the Peary Woods case, which quoted Queen Victoria, who, you know, I forget what her exact words were, who didn't believe that sex between women was something that women would do,
right,
because, of course, women only submitted to sex in order to have children.
Yes. The apocryphal story is that when male homosexuality was criminalized in late 19th century England, and she was to sign the bill that would do that, her prime minister suggested that perhaps female-female sexuality should be added to that bill as a criminal act. And Queen Victoria supposedly said, there's no such thing.
Okay, well, we start out in To Believe in Women in the 19th century, talking about the feminist movement here, and how most of the women had not gotten familiarity with that new concept of the invert. So they had what was considered, quote-unquote, Boston marriages or passionate friendships. And in fact, many of them believed this is what made them better feminists. Talk about that.
Yes, and I think clearly many of those relationships were sexual, although from the outside that wasn't widely acknowledged. But this book is very different from the other books because I ask several questions. I ask, for example, how did American women get the vote? How did American women get into higher education? How did American women get into the professions? How did America get the kind of social conscience that we've been familiar with for much of the 20th century? And my focus there is on showing how women were in what we would today call lesbian couples, were in the forefront of all of those battles, and for good reason. It's not simply my lesbian chauvinism that sees them as being in the forefront of those battles. First of all, we have to remember that this was before the days of jet age travel. If you were going to work for a cause and you had to travel around the country, really took a lot of days out of the year. If we remember that a typical Victorian mother, a married woman before the days of birth control, of course, most married women were mothers in the Victorian era before the days of effective birth control, a typical married woman would have about 5 children, and many of them had between 7 and 12 children. So, of course, they couldn't put the energy into the movement as Susan B. Anthony or Carrie Chapman Catt or Anna Howard Shaw could, women who did not have children, women whose primary relationships were with other women in committed, very often erotic, certainly very passionate love relationships. There were other things going on, too. This was the day of the huge Victorian household, and if you were in charge of running a huge household, even if you had a few servants, that was a full-time job.
Well, you were managing them.
So. Yeah, right. And even
managing
if you managed
employees.
Them, the typical middle-class Victorian woman spent 5 hours a day in the kitchen, managing the employees, but also helping out, making meals for a family. So you can't run a movement if you're going to spend 5 hours a day in the kitchen. And then there were other things going on as well. It seems to me that these women that I'll call lesbians, although they didn't have that term in the 19th century or early 20th century. They didn't have an acceptable term to identify them. But we can call them lesbians if we look at the nature of their lives. These women were virtually fighting for their lives, or at least for the quality of their lives. If no man was going to support them, of course they needed a higher education. Of course they needed access to the professions. And so they fought for that. If no man was going to represent them at the polls or in politics, of course they needed the vote. So I think they had an emotional commitment to these various movements that heterosexual women might not have had. And in addition to that, if the significant other in your life is another woman, you really feel doubly the plight of women. And I think that's also what made them want to stand shoulder to shoulder with other women to fight for equal rights.
I've stood your foolishness long enough. Oh, now I'm gonna call your bluff. On certain things I'm gonna call your hand. So now, Daddy, here's my plan. I ain't gonna play no second fiddle, 'cause I'm used to playing.
That was lesbian historian Lillian Fatterman in conversation with This Way Out's Josie Kitogio about surpassing the love of men and to believe in women. Fatterman's latest book is Naked in the Promised Land.
This is Mark Tewksbury, Olympic champion and proud board member of Montreal 2006. You're listening to This Way Out, International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine.
As if the pressures of parenthood weren't enough, gays and lesbians with children face many unique challenges, including social prejudice and a frequently unfriendly legal system. The documentary Daddy and Papa examines the lives of four families headed by gay fathers. A favorite at gay and lesbian film festivals around the world, the 60-minute film has won more than 10 major awards and will enjoy its broadcast debut on U.S. public television stations in early June. This Way Out's Steve Pride chats with filmmaker Johnny Simons and his partner William Rogers about the film and about their own journey to parenthood.
Director-producer Johnny Simons and his partner William Rogers are a San Francisco interracial couple who adopted an African-American baby named Zachary. Simons chronicled their story and the story of other gay dads in his award-winning documentary, Daddy and Papa.
Hey, Zachary, what's my name? Is my name Daddy?
No.
No?
What's his name?
What's my name?
That's Daddy.
Well, that's Daddy. What's my name?
Daddy Papa.
Daddy Papa.
Daddy.
So who's Daddy?
Daddy.
Where's Daddy?
Daddy.
And who's that?
Papa. Papa, Daddy.
I'm Johnny Simons.
And I'm William Rogers.
We started the film when a friend of ours, Kelly, announced one night when we were having dinner with him that he was going to be adopting two kids. He's a single gay man. He lives in the middle of the Castro and comes from a fairly conservative Catholic family. And I thought, he's going to be on an interesting journey and I want to follow him. So I asked if I could, you know, do some filming. And as I was beginning that process and then found a couple other families that I was interested in filming too, all of that really came first. And then somewhere along the line, William and I decided that we wanted to adopt as well. And I felt like, oh, geez, I'm filming all these other families. It's only fair to turn the camera on us as well. So I did. And what I realized is that I could film a lot more of what was going on in our lives. And so that ended up becoming a big part of the final film.
Like most other gay men, William Rogers hadn't thought parenthood was an option.
I definitely always wanted children. But I think for me, when I actually saw that Kelly was able to adopt, it was the first time that it sort of clicked in my head that it was a possibility. There's always the notion that if you're gay, oh my God, you're not going to have children. And the sort of the stereotypical response by mothers is, but now I'm not going to have grandchildren. And the fact is that I think watching other people adopt helped me to realize that we actually could do it. And we started fairly soon into the process after Johnny started thinking about making the film.
The decision made, geography became an important factor.
In California, we're actually pretty lucky because they've changed the laws. And so it used to be that two men could not adopt together. Back in the day, we would have had to have adopted separately, and then one of us would have had to come back and do a second parent adoption. And it also used to be that the state would always recommend against adoption by an unmarried couple or a single person. But that's changed. And so we were actually able to adopt together as a couple. So we were both the legal parents of our kids, and both of our names are on their birth certificate.
Although Johnny and William were able to become Daddy and Papa, gay men living in some other states have been less fortunate.
There's three families in the film that live in California and one that lives in Florida. And I chose the family that lives in Florida specifically because they were involved in a class action lawsuit to try and overturn the ban on gay adoption, which exists there. The family is a nurse practitioner who became the legal guardian of a boy who he saw in his clinic. The boy came in with his biological father, and the father basically said, "I can't take care of this child anymore. Do you want him?" And so the nurse made a very quick decision and said, "Yes, I'll take him," and brought him home. And 5 years have gone by now, and he's still the legal guardian, but he can't adopt. So he's in the process of suing the state. And that's all traced in the film. And as Rosie O'Donnell has brought a lot of notoriety to it, which is, I think, is fantastic, suddenly people are really realizing what the situation is in Florida. And even though in many other states, there's sort of a gradual loosening of the laws around gay adoption, there are still three states, Florida, Mississippi, and Utah, that outlaw gay adoption. And there are other fairly conservative states that are in the process of trying to enact that kind of legislation. So in a sense, legally, the country is becoming more progressive and also more conservative at the same time, depending on which state you live in.
There are also a lot of informal obstacles to gay adoption as well, because the social workers have a tremendous amount of power and control over where the child is placed. Foster parents have a role in that. Administrators have a role in that. And some of it is just about people's personal beliefs. So it's a little insidious, and it makes it more difficult to fight because it's not as apparent as a formal law is.
And once past the homosexual stereotypes, gay dads face a second damaging cliche.
There is a real cultural assumption, number one, that men cannot parent. We're not nurturing. We sort of have that Mr. Mom thing that goes on, that we're sort of completely inept. And then I do think that that's institutionalized.
There's a lot of subtle discrimination that happens against dads, and particularly against two-dad families. You know, if a kid is sort of wandering around, someone will say, "Well, where's your mommy?" to the little kid. I mean, it's all these things where I think watching our kids have to adjust to that, you know, and have to kind of come to terms with, well, no, I don't have a mommy, and yet that's okay. And then, in a sense, they're teaching, we're all teaching the rest of the world to accept our family as legitimate as any other.
Daddy and Papa will air nationally on PBS stations across the United States on Tuesday, June 3rd. Check your local listings. And the documentary continues to screen at film festivals around the world. For more information or to see when it might be in a city near you, point your internet browser to daddyandpapa.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Hush it, baby, don't say a word. I'm gonna buy you a mockingbird. And if that mockingbird won't sing, Papa gonna buy you a diamond.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Ralph Radabaugh, Graham Underhill, Fensberry, Rex Walkner, Josie Cotoggio, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Bessie Smith and Bobby McFerrin performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. To find out how you can help keep This Way Out on the air and get some queer audio history and timeless music in the bargain, please visit our website at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks very much for listening on WLUW Chicago, Illinois, Access Radio Wellington, New Zealand, KUMD Duluth, Minnesota, and more than 135 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And we know you'll stay tuned.